Like one way you could think about it is it helps us defer new investment in generation. So let's say you don't believe, like you're not convinced that solar is going to be cheaper. I don't know how you could be, but like, let's say you're not, you don't have to make that decision right now. Put some batteries on the grid. That will shift the power around. You're always going to want to do that no matter what sort of generation you have. And that lets you defer investment in new generation for a few more years, and you can then decide what you want to do.
And are there like any countries or regions you'd highlight as successfully balancing innovation with regulation?
That's a good question. I mean, there's highlights and lowlights, I think, in many different countries' approach to these policies. I actually think, like, you know, polarization in the U.S. Is probably making the environment there not very friendly. One advantage for the U.S. is that you have like the states, the sort of state system, and there's some sort of laboratories of innovation. Ironically, if you look at the U.S., the places where batteries are being deployed the fastest, there's two states. California is one. The other one is Texas. And like, I mean, you can't think of like, those are the two bastions. If you think in the U.S., like in the political system, California is like it's the center of the liberal democratic world. Texas is the center of the conservative Republican world, right? And the fact that these two polar opposites are deploying this technology the fastest signals to me, on one hand, it is the best possible technology for addressing sort of things like climate change, right? And then on the other hand, presumably in libertarian Texas, they're not going to deploy a technology unless it is the best possible technology for techno-economics. And in that world, it's even probably more interesting because there's this sort of general political pushback in the U.S., which I don't understand, because these are just things, right? This is an asset that you deploy. There's nothing political about an asset, but like there is pushback that, like, you know, solar is bad or wind is bad, batteries are bad, EVs are bad, but like the fact it's still being deployed there means that even over these sort of political objections, it's still the most profitable thing to put there. So if you're a smart investor, you should be investing in these technologies because it wins in any sort of environment.
And with the global energy transition, requires companies to not only scale quickly, but also act responsibly. How is Peak Energy embedding sustainability and climate alignment into your core strategy as you grow?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's at the core of why we do what we do. Going back to what I said in the beginning, like I see our mission as sort of taking away all the excuses. And, you know, that's one way to think about it. But it might be that, you know, we're all wrong, right? And climate change is fake, and I don't believe that. But like, even in that situation, I still think batteries are the best, like economically most viable technology. And no matter what you believe in terms of climate change or sustainability, the next 100 years are going to be dominated by, things like AI, autonomy, robots. Already everyone has a phone in their pocket. EVs are by far the cheapest. If you look in China, for instance, like they're by far the cheapest new vehicles you can buy. And in the US, they're already pretty much on parity. I think Canada, probably Europe, like it's inevitable. These things are the most efficient next generation technology. It's going to be everywhere else. So we should be investing in these technologies. If the West does not get good at doing this, in a world where we're worried about certain countries being geopolitical rivals, you don't want those countries to have a monopoly on a foundational technology. And you know, batteries, more so than even things like solar panels or wind or whatever, I think the only thing that kind of rivals batteries for strategic importance in the supply chain, apart from any kind of climate concerns, is semiconductors. Semiconductors are in everything. Batteries are also in everything. And if we can't make them, we can't make anything.
Mm-hmm. And could you share an example where Peak Energy had to make like a tough call or like to prioritize long-term sustainability over short-term wins?
That's a good question. We're only 2 years old. I think this is a nuance. This is a pretty nuanced thing, and I've seen two approaches of this. Right, one was at Tesla, the other one was at Northvolt. Right, mm-hmm. And I'm not going to make any. I'm just going to give you kind of what I've seen. I'll tell you kind of how I think about it. But like at Tesla, the whole mission of the company was around like how do we get this technology out there? How do we make it better than everything else? So that there's kind of like we didn't ever say it this way, but it was like we want to just make this the thing that everybody wants to buy, right? Mm-hmm. Better car than anything else. You're not buying it because it's electric. You're buying it because it's better. And that was our mission. And it was in service of trying to transition transport to more sustainable methods, right? And because that was our North Star, we weren't really that focused on, like, we didn't care that much if our factories ran on green power, right? Because the idea was if you can electrify all of transport, the fact that one factory might have not the cleanest power in the world, but it's cheaper, like it's better to electrify all transport, and then you can address that. Because, or it will actually just get addressed because you've transitioned like a huge part of the economy to this, and then it's, you know, that's some other company's problem, right? So it's a, like a question of like specialization and prioritization. Northvolt had the opposite approach. It's part of our core value proposition that we wanted to source like green power for our factories and things like that. We spent a lot of bandwidth thinking about those problems, and we did. Like I think a lot of that was good work, and really. But at the end of the day, it wasn't really core to achieving that mission. And I sometimes wonder if we had been a bit more pragmatic about trying to make sure that our primary objective, which was like let's build more batteries, like get them out there, electrify more applications. If Northvolt was around today, you would have a lot less geopolitical risk with respect to China. I think you would have less tariff pressure, less like, because these actions are reaction to an over concentration of a critical commodity in a country that is increasingly at odds politically with Western thought, right? And one way you alleviate that pressure is you have other alternatives to buy that from. And that's one of the things I think is important about Peak's mission. Now, all of that said, like you need to have a balanced approach here. But I think if you're too dogmatic on saying like every electron that comes into our factory needs to be green, that's probably bad because it's just going to make you more expensive, slower than your competition who doesn't care at all. Mm-hmm. But if you're too laissez-faire about it and say, I don't care if I buy, you know, we don't use cobalt in our batteries, but let's say if we did, I don't care if I buy cobalt from someone who might be using child labor and really exploiting like horrible practices somewhere, right? That's also a problem. Like, that's not okay, right? Mm-hmm. So I think you have to have a bit of a pragmatic approach, but not lose sight of your ultimate objective. Because if you're too focused on trying to do everything perfectly along the way, you're gonna move too slowly and fail the longer term objective.
Oh, okay. And looking ahead, what does success look like for Peak Energy over like the next 5 to 10 years? Not just in terms of like business growth, but also in the impact you want to have on the climate crisis.
Yeah, I think. It's really about two things, like bringing the cost down of battery storage and deploying it as fast as we possibly can to all the places it needs to deploy. And we do that through designing a product that is both techno-economically better. So for asset owners who are like a utility company or an independent power producer in the US, they can deploy this asset to the grid, and it's cheaper for them to deploy and to operate than the alternative asset. And that means that as the grid gets greener, it doesn't get more expensive, which is a critical thing, right? Like, I think politicians and folks who are really focused on climate change undervalued how important it was for us to ensure that as we go through this transition, not too much of the economic consequence in the transition is felt by folks who probably are already struggling, right? And you see the reaction to that. No matter what you believe, I think you could be dogmatic about it and say it doesn't really matter if you're making a little less money, if the world is ended in like 30 years. That's all true. Sure. Right. But like if you're along that way, this is an addiction. Like, there's no dictatorship in the ways we're doing this, right? We're there's no politician out there that can unilaterally in the West just say, well, suck it up, pay more rates. Like, I don't care if you're unhappy. What ends up happening is if people pay too much for power, they're going to react to it, and there's going to be a backlash against green tech, right? And that's what's happening certainly in Europe. It's definitely happening in the U.S. right now. And so I think that's why we have to hold ourselves to a higher standard and say, yeah, it's similar to what we did at Tesla. Like, it was not okay to just build an electric car that people would buy because it was green. We had to build an electric car that people would buy. Of course, it was green. People were happy about that. But you bought it because it was a better car. I see it the same way for, like, energy technology. We shouldn't be out there saying, like, pay me a green premium. Green premium is actually in, it's against, like, what we should be trying to do, because it ultimately means that people, everyday people, some of who care about climate change, some of who don't, are going to pay more in their power bills. And if you do too much of that, they're gonna push back on this technology, and it creates a long-term vulnerability. Mm-hmm.
And with China, wanted to actually ask about this. Is China, like, really, like, a rivaling partner? Like, how are you guys navigating with the whole situation between China and the U.S. regarding this?
Yeah, I was a Chinese, an economics and Chinese major in college. And I like, it was my dream from high school when I first started learning about China. I became fascinated with the place. To work and live over there, spent some time in college, semesters abroad there, two semesters, and then did an internship, and then I lived in Singapore, but worked in China a ton the first 2 years out of college, and so I think China is one of my favorite places in the world to go. The people are incredible, the culture is super interesting, the history is fascinating. I think if you've never spent time over there, it's like, it's one of the most incredible places in the world. They work so hard. They're so innovative. The people are just wonderful. It breaks my heart in some ways that, like, that there is this, like, increasing gap between China and, you know, the U.S., the country I'm from, and in some cases, like, the West generally. And, like, I hope that slows down. And I hope it reverses. And I think it will. Because I think ultimately we're all more similar than we're different. And we're symbiotic in a lot of ways. At the same time, I recognize that there is a risk of over-concentration in these technologies, especially when there is a possibility of decoupling. And so I think the right approach here is to build a viable supply chain that can stand on its own feet. And in general, any commodity, like, you don't want to have any critical commodity in the entire world that, like, literally only has one place it can come from. Like, that's just a vulnerability. Could have a natural disaster. It doesn't have to be politically driven, right? So I think the right thing is to diversify enough so that you have a choice to supply from, you know, China or from the US or from Europe, and, like, in these critical commodities. You don't have to have it absolutely everywhere, but you need some diversity in supply. And so that's our goal. And, like, that's the way we work with partners in China. We have really phenomenal partners in China, really great people. They're great at what they do. They're the best in the world at batteries. So we're trying to learn from them. We're trying to work with them long-term. I hope that we can build, you know, very long-term partnerships. But, and I would see that for kind of any commodity that we're doing, our goal should be that we can continue to purchase some of that from China. I would hope we can always do that, but that we can also build a lot at home and sort of combine these two things so that we have a diversity of supply.
Okay, that's really interesting. And last question is, so what milestones are you, like, most focused on in the near terms regarding Peak?
Yeah, so we have a pilot, our first, like, sort of customer-facing pilot coming up. We did our internal pilot demonstrator last year with our first systems. The first customer pilot is launching in just a few months. We're building it in California today. And then we have some larger customer deliveries coming in next year, but the really big ones are in 2027, so we're laser focused on that. One of the things that we want to do most, like, it's deeply core to the mission of Peak, is domestically manufacturing batteries, and we've got sort of all the pieces lined up to do domestic battery manufacturing, domestic in the U.S. Battery manufacturing, which would come online in 2027. Now, that is, like, will be very dependent on what happens in Congress that's sort of going through in the budget reconciliation process right now. There's changes to this law called the IRA that the Biden administration passed. Our factory, our battery factory, and I would argue that almost every other battery factory in the U.S. long-term depends on that legislation not being totally repealed or crippled. And where we are in the process today is that the House passed a version of the reconciliation bill that basically implements changes to the IRA, which make it impossible to build a battery factory. Mm-hmm. So it's in the Senate right now. We're working with senators and also with Congress people to try to fix these provisions so that it's not it doesn't basically reverse the nascent industry that's just starting to form. We've only had a few years with the IRA to get these going, and building a battery factory doesn't happen overnight. It takes years. So we need some time to get this industry on its feet. And I hope that happens. I hope we can reverse some of those changes, because, you know, it would sort of break my heart if we end up having to build these factories in other places. I think, it's really technology that we should be doing in North America.
All right. Thank you so much for that. Honestly, a lot of interesting stuff there, mm-hmm. really. All I can say is thank you.
Yeah.
Magic Triangle from their record Trapo Casual. It's Coco. You can see them performing at Music Waste this weekend. More info at musicwaste.ca. Thanks to Senya for that interview with Landon Mossberg. Super interesting stuff about the future of clean tech and batteries and all that stuff. And now, as promised, we're going to go to a story from Smithers, where a huge celebrity, Tony Hawk, was in town to celebrate the opening of a new skate park. That'll be it, and that'll take us to Democracy Now! So thanks for listening to me. Thanks to Pam from CICK for putting together this report. And I will see you pretty soon. Check out all of our programming today. Check out Speak Up, Listen Up, Act Upon tomorrow with Charlotte. And I'll see you on Tuesday.
This is CICK News. Today on CICK News, I was at the skate park on Thursday, May 29th for a very special skate demo, and I caught up with the Smithers Skate Park Society board member, Sarah Fitzmaurice, to find out just how this amazing event happened.
I'm Sarah Fitzmaurice, and I'm one of the fundraisers for the Smithers Skate Park Society.
How did you get Tony Hawk and his crew to come to Smithers?
So we have some local foundations here in Smithers that have contributed to different phases of the skate park expansion. And through those foundations, we were introduced to Power to Give, which is a foundation on Vancouver Island. And so through that connection, we met the people involved in the Tony Hawk Foundation and also the Mark McMorris Foundation. I believe their foundations do projects together. And so that's really how the introduction was made. And back in January, we did a call with all the different stakeholders, and things went from there.
Okay. And so who was involved with the latest extension?
It's a partnership between the Smithers Skate Park Society, the Town of Smithers, and the Office of the Wet'suwet'en Youth Moody, or Youth Leadership. And so for this phase three, we received a contribution from Power to Give, but also we've received contributions from a lot of different individuals and companies in Smithers.
What were some of the reactions that you saw there or that you heard that really just cemented your belief that Smithers deserves a skate park like this and for an international legend to show up and skate on it?
Just the crowd reaction, they were just so excited, so honored. Tony really took the time to connect with youth, especially the singers and dancers who came from Witsa. We really wanted to make sure that they had an audience, and they just sang beautifully and provided such an amazing welcome for the event. I witnessed a kid named Ian Sear, who makes miniature skateboards, like that all are all the kind of the Birdhouse brand coloring, and he presented that to Tony, who was really touched by that. And I wanted to mention that Tony and his crew showed up at the skate park the day before and borrowed the kids' skate boards that were there and just skated the park. And to see a 12-year-old boy crying because he's so overwhelmed, it was just so beautiful.
Do you know how many people? I was guessing maybe 1700, but do you know or have a guess of how many people showed up on Thursday?
We don't. We thought there would be 300, and there were definitely over 1,000.
Yeah, I'd say I was looking and I thought comfortably there's probably about 1500 people here, it seemed.
Yeah, Tony tried to give us some guidelines about crowd control and barriers and things like that because we'd never done an event like this. And originally we thought, oh, maybe he doesn't know that Smithers is a town of 5,000 with one flight in a day. But boy, were we ever wrong.
Since becoming a nonprofit in 2020, dedicated volunteers and partners have worked tirelessly to make this project possible. This skate park is a testament to community collaboration with support from the Town of Smithers and the Office of the Wet'suwet'en Youth Leadership Program, or Moody. The park offers low-barrier, unstructured play for youth, an affordable alternative to organized sports. The Smithers Skate Park Society are now fundraising for phase four, which includes a pump track, permanent washrooms, and a picnic area, aiming to break ground in 2026.
Okay, guys, so the way today's gonna work is we are going to have some surprise guests show up very shortly to do a demo for you. Yeah.
That is the voice of Everett Tetz of New Line, an internationally renowned full-service municipal skate park design and construction team who emceed the event that you were either at or you heard about on the news and social media last week when Tony Hawk, Grayson Fletcher, and Lizzie Armanto, who are all professional skateboarders, arrived at the Smithers Skate Park to a crowd of over 1,000 people to demo the latest expansion of the Smithers Skate Park. They were welcomed by Kayla Mitchell and the Ekkaya Hosley Drummers to a very excitable crowd.
I'm so honored to be here, and I just want to introduce myself. I'm Kayla. I'm Deputy Chief of Witsa First Nation, and I'm here today to introduce to you some of our hereditary leaders. So although I'm the leader of our village in Witsa over there, this territory belongs to our stewards of the land. And so if we want to give a really warm welcome to our Sakai Nik Sawit, who has been caretaking this land for a long time. Miss Sayas, give it up for Sawit!
Before the main event, young skateboarders were given lessons by skate park volunteers for a learn to skate afternoon in the park for youth from ages 7 to 13. What's your name?
My name is Patrick.
Okay, and so you're volunteering for this event, Learn to Skate, but you're also here for this big demo. Is this the turnout that you expected?
Yeah, absolutely. It's everybody's heard about it. Big stars coming in, so it's a big thing for Smithers.
Yeah. How did the Learn to Skate go today? I mean, I still see lots of little people out there on their skateboards, but how did it go today?
It actually went really well. We saw lots of improvements in a lot of the kids, and a lot of them also got free gear, so that'll probably encourage them to do some more.
For sure. Thank you very much, Patrick.
Yeah, thank you.
Rob Nisbet.
Okay.
Okay. So were you here for the Learn to Skate day so far?
Yeah.
What were some of the skills that were being taught today at Learn to Skate?
We learned how to push, how to stand on a board, how to just get your balance, how to drop in on a little ramp. And yeah, they all got all those maneuvers pretty quickly.
Yeah. How do you think of the skate parks being received ever since it was built? And were you involved in...
Yeah, I mean, I grew up skateboarding and I love the skate park. And the fact that we got the new park, I mean, it's like, it just puts so much more creativity back into someone like me who's like almost 50. And watching the younger kids just shred the park is super fun to do.
Yeah.
I was involved. I built the new shelter here. So.
Oh, nice. Oh,
yeah, and just some of the new concrete work in the around the shelter. And the B4B bank, of course, was a beautiful idea that we got to bring to a reality.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I guess lastly, do the kids know, like, how excited are they about the superstars?
Coming to the skate park last few days just to come skate, just everybody's just like, so is it true? And I'm just like, I don't know. And like, I had a hard time keeping it a secret, honestly, because I just think it's so cool that not only do we get a new park, but we get like this interest sort of, you know, from beyond Smithers borders, and Terrace is here and a bunch of Prince George kids. And it's really cool that this event is turning out as big as it is, and just seeing a lot of kids just like, they don't want to get off their skateboards.
Yeah.
It's rad.
Well, thank you so much.
Thanks, fam.
It looks like a few trucks have just pulled up. And we're going to find out if those rumors are actually true.
Among the throngs of kids skating, their parents watching, and people of all ages waiting, all of a sudden, with very little pomp and circumstance, Tony arrived.
Are you guys excited for that? Can you guys stand at the bottom of the hill? All right, we got to give them a little bit of space. So we're going to start with our traditional welcome. Come on up, ladies.
Hi, Saiful, Dave, Ramona. I'm from the Lipsiliu clan, and we are here to help welcome the expansion of the park. We're Akaya Hosley, which means bringing it back to life. And we are going to start off with honoring the territory that we're on. This is unceded territory of the Wet'suwet'en, and we are going to start off with a Gidimdan Kaskan song, which means small bear.
Bringing these skaters to Smithers is a massive boon to the skate park and all of the partners involved. Sarah shared with me a part of their visit that struck me as unique to the Wet'suwet'en territory that Smithers resides on, and to consider the history of the land that we play on.
The morning of the 29th, I should mention in terms of the partnership with Kayla and the Office of the Wet'suwet'en Youth, and youth from Wet'suwet'en, but really her team came up with this, a learning on the land session. From 10 to 12, we took the athletes up to the lookout, which is on the way up the Hudson Bay Mountain. And she and her team and her youth did a learning on the land session. They taught the group Wet'suwet'en words. They had maps of the territory, and they took us through a few different ceremonies, and it was incredible. They did drumming, and I could see that the athletes, many of them, Tony included, had never experienced anything like that before. They talked about the murdered and missing Indigenous women, and also why that lookout was important in terms of the town's history. It was just phenomenal. People were crying. It really moved people. And this is the kind of thing when you partner with Indigenous organizations that you get so connected to the history of that place. And it was probably my favorite part of the entire 3 days that we had them here.
Thank you to Sarah, Patrick, and Rob for their interviews at the Smithers Skate Park when Tony Hawk, a 58-year-old man, absolutely shredded in Smithers. CSK News is funded by the Government of Canada, the Community Radio Fund of Canada, and is a participating station in the Local Journalism Initiative. On behalf of my colleague Dan Messick and myself, Pam Hassan, thanks for listening.
Thanks to Pam and CICK and Frequency News for that really cool story. I'm Jesse. This has been Speak Up on CJSF 90.1 FM Burnaby. You can find that story at frequencynews.ca and other stuff at cjsf.ca. Democracy Now! Is on right.